Court, Mr. Ho will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court. This case presents a fundamental question. What should courts do when government regulation conflicts with a religious practice? The Texas legislature answered that question when it enacted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. In that act, the legislature made a policy judgment that courts should favor the religious practice unless the government can override that presumption.
Well, how does requiring this facility to move to a different part of the county have an impact or affect the religious practice here?
In this case, Your Honor, the ordinance effectively requires a pre-existing facility and expels it from the city limits. That's not just a substantial burden, Your Honor. That is an outright prohibition. And that satisfies any accepted definition of the term substantial burden.
Was the ordinance enacted after the facility and the church and this ministry were in place, or was it the ordinance? Did the ordinance exist first?
The facility was in operation.
And then the ordinance came.
Right. And if you think about sort of the typical zoning ordinance, you know, ordinarily you have a zoning ordinance, sets up a scheme, and it often grandfathers in pre-existing uses. The fact that this was a pre-existing use, I think, adds to the burden. We would submit that any move, to be honest, would constitute substantial burden, but this case is particularly easy and extreme on that regard.
The briefs contradict each other on whether the record shows that felons are among the inhabitants of the facilities. Can you straighten that out?
I would be happy to, Your Honor. There have been felons in the past, nonviolent offenders. The record is clear on that point. Pastor Barr additionally noted that going forward in the future, he would be interested in limiting it to just misdemeanor offenses.
Does the disposition of that case turn on whether felons are inhabitants or not of these facilities?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And it goes to the heart of what the compelling interest standard adopted by the Texas RFRA statute.
So if that doesn't turn the case, then assume with me that the church's ministry reached out, that their ministry reached out to sexually violent predators, felons who had sexually violent predator history. Could a city prohibit people, those sorts of convicts, from being residents within so many yards of a school?
Well, I welcome the opportunity, Your Honor, to try to ease the court's concerns in that regard. A couple of thoughts. First, let's keep in mind that under the city's view, you and I aren't even allowed to have this conversation. This is a conversation that should have taken place in the trial court. Texas RFRA does not provide a free pass to either government or religion. It's simply providing a process under which the government would have the opportunity and the burden to come in and explain its considerations. The case that you've laid out, Your Honor, the government will undoubtedly have ample evidence, and it will win that case. This case is very, very different. The government here, first of all, denied it had any duty whatsoever to present any case. It could just fold up its arms and say, look at the law, and that's the end of the story. In addition, this ordinance does not distinguish between misdemeanor traffic offenses and sexual offenders, serial murderers, or other more severe categories. That's exactly the problem with this ordinance, Your Honor. It treats the homes as if they have an open-door policy to every criminal in the state, when quite the contrary, it is undisputed in the record of this case that Pastor Barr has employed a very carefully screened process. He's not interested in violent offenders. He said that from the outset. That's completely undisputed.
But your case doesn't turn on whether felons would be inhabitants or not, right? I just don't understand why that makes a difference to the church's case here.
Well, it shouldn't make a difference in this case, Your Honor, because the city simply has not even acknowledged its duty, let alone presented the evidence.
We're going to be having to write an opinion that governs not just this case, but other cases that may come in the future. And so my question is it a point that turns our decision whether felons are inhabitants, whether violent or nonviolent or sexually violent predators? I mean, does the character of the ex-convict make a difference or not?
I think what turns this case is not the character of a particular category of offenses, but rather the kinds of evidence that the city presents. Let's say, for example, the city at trial, let's say on remand, submitted ample evidence that was convincing to a court that every felon in the state should not be in this facility. That's not what they did here. They didn't provide any of it. Let's say they had. Even then, even in that situation, Your Honor, Pastor Barr would be entitled to an injunction. Now, it would be a limited injunction. It would be crafted only with respect to certain kinds of offenders, misdemeanors only, for would be a particularly narrow class. But we'd still be entitled to an injunction. I'd prefer the Court's attention, for example, to the very recent and unanimous decision by the United States Supreme Court in Gonzalez versus UDV. In that case, applying the federal RFRA law, the Court found that it is not enough for the government to simply sit back and say, look at this law, it's a very important law, and that's all we need. The U.S. Supreme Court specifically instructed that the government has to present evidence not about the statute, but about the application of that statute, the particular class of individuals. Not only that, not only are we concerned about the class of individuals who might be accepted as residents, but what kinds of measures? What are the least restrictive means for furthering any particular interest the government has? Why do you need outright prohibition, as in this case? There could have been more moderate measures. In fact, the city talks about supervision, security.
Or any other facilities impacted by the ordinance?
There are no facilities in the record, Your Honor, that would have been affected one way or another. This appears to be the only one, and in fact, this was the motivation for the ordinance.
Without the Religious Freedom of Restoration Act, would the standard applicable here be strict scrutiny or some lesser standard?
You know, it's an interesting question. It's thankfully one that we don't have addressed, but sort of hypothetically, there are a couple of things that we would look to. First, there would be the federal RLUIPA statute, which would apply to any zoning, any land use in the country, so long as it meets the federal jurisdictional requirements, interstate commerce, that sort of thing. Second, even if we don't have that, this is something on which scholars have disagreed, but what does Smith leave? There appears to be an argument that Sherbert actually survived Smith in this narrow setting when you have individualized government assessments. In fact, there have been cases where after Smith, courts continue to apply compelling interest in zoning cases. None of those academic questions are necessary here, of course, because we do have the Texas RFRA statute as well as the federal RLUIPA statute.
Is there a distinction between religious belief and religious activity? Because, you know, their beliefs don't seem to be impacted by this ordinance, but certainly their activity is impacted.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think Texas RFRA itself answers this question. In .001 of the statute, the legislature defines what it means by free exercise of religion, what it's trying to protect in the statute. And it says not just a belief, but an act or refusal to act that is substantially motivated by sincere religious belief. In this case, there is no dispute, and the Court of Appeals, in fact, stipulated that this was, in fact, substantially motivated by sincere religious belief.
Well, in the Adkins case, the Fifth Circuit has examined the Supreme Court cases and has come up with a definition, and they say that the governmental action creates a substantial burden on religious exercise. That would be the conduct we're talking about here. If it truly pressures the adherent to significantly modify his religious behavior and significantly violates his religious beliefs. Now, before we ever get to the question of compelling state interest, we have to have a substantial burden. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And do you agree or disagree with the Adkins definition of substantial burden?
Well, that case, Your Honor, like many others, states a general proposition. There are additional cases which supply a zoning-specific definition of what substantial burden is. And let's look to the Fifth Circuit, for example, in the Islamic Center decision. There you had a new facility, where there were alternative locations even within city limits. Even in that case, Your Honor, the Fifth Circuit said that was, in fact, a substantial burden, and, in fact, it was a constitutional violation in that case. This case is even easier, and there are the two factors that I would point to. One, it's not just a move. We would submit that any move would pose a burden. But here, it's an expulsion from the city. Second, this is expulsion of a facility that could have been grandfathered in. It preexisted the ordinance. And I would submit, if that is not a substantial burden, we've essentially carved out zoning from the statute.
Well, is substantial burden simply... If you just have to move from one place to another, does that impose a substantial burden? What if they had to move two blocks down the street?
Well, there are two.
I know that's not your case.
Yes, sir.
But what if that's all that were required? Would that be a substantial burden?
In that different case, Your Honor, I would propose that the Seventh Circuit's test, articulated by Judge Posner, is an appropriate standard. In that case, Judge Posner, analyzing pre-1990 case law, says that any delay, uncertainty, or expense would in fact constitute a substantial burden.
Not just a burden, but any delay, in that case you wouldn't even have to have material. I mean, there's a difference between a burden and a substantial burden. And so your position would be any type of burden that made them alter their conduct, i.e. walking two blocks down the street to conduct this activity, would be a substantial burden?
Well, it wouldn't always be. I mean, if we're talking about just walking down the street,
that's the example I just gave you. If the ordinance required only to be moved two blocks down the street and they could do it in the house down there, is that a substantial burden? So that any movement, or if not, how much is a substantial burden as opposed to a burden? That's what I think I'm struggling with.
Certainly. Thankfully, this case is an easier one, but I understand the idea of wanting to articulate a broader rule. Judge Posner, I think, has articulated a standard that is faithful to the text. It has to be substantial burden. It doesn't mean insurmountable, and it doesn't mean incidental. For example, if a zoning ordinance were to say you have to, a fire code, for example, you have to allow inspectors to come into your facility to make sure you're complying with fire codes. First of all, that would presumably be a compelling interest. I'm not even sure that would be a substantial burden.
Okay. What is the religious practice that's being burdened here? Is it the rehabilitation? Is it the teaching? Or is it the meeting in a particular place?
In this case, Your Honor, I would submit it is all of the above. It is unquestioned.
Meeting in a particular place is religion? Is the religion to simply meet in a particular place?
Well, not in theory, Your Honor, not in the abstract. I think it depends specifically on the particular facts in the case and the particular record that's available. In this case, there's no question of his sincerity, and there's no question that Pastor Barr firmly believes, and his application process firmly confirms, that living together with others who are traveling the same path, that is not only a religious activity, it's a powerful positive reinforcement. I take it that's
where?
The central...
Where? Does that have to be, does he have to be there? It's simply, if they let him do it, if he moves six blocks away, but he can do the same thing six blocks away, get him in there, treat. He gets to conduct his religious activities, to have them together and to teach them, but he just has to move a little further away. That's still a substantial burden?
Well, I think there are two questions in what Your Honor is saying. One is what constitutes the religious activity, and separately, what would be a burden on that activity?
Exactly.
So going to the first point, what is religious activity?
Let's go to this question. Is the place where it's conducted religious activity? That's what we're talking about here. They haven't said you can't do it. You just can't do it in certain places, which is going to make you move out. Is the place it's conducted religious activity?
Well, let's start with a couple of sort of maybe easier propositions. First of all, the fact that a church is necessary to engage in group worship. You could take the position, well, you don't have to be in a church. You could practice at home. You could do it individually. Nevertheless, the courts are consistent in regarding the protection of churches as a place of group worship, as religious activity. Second, in this case, living together with others traveling the same religious path as you, in a particular setting designed for such activities, I would submit is a religious activity. Here, the record is clear at page 33. Every day starts at 5:30 with prayer.
Couldn't they do it outside the city?
Well, that's the substantial burden point, and we
Fine.
Would submit.
That's what I'm saying on religion. That's a substantial burden on where they're doing it. Is that a substantial burden on religion because the location has to be changed?
Well, the Fifth Circuit has told us so in the Islamic Center case. We could also look, for example, to the U.S. Supreme Court in Sherbert. There, all we're talking about is getting another job or losing your unemployment compensation. In that case, the court was quite clear that just a few dollars, or probably substantial dollars, nevertheless, that's a substantial burden. And that's exactly why Judge Posner, in the Seventh Circuit case, presents the notion that really any substantial delay, uncertainty, or expense would constitute a substantial burden. Here, what more could the city have done to prohibit this entity?
Do you think any regulation targets religious activity can be insubstantial?
I suppose it's possible. It's unlikely. I mean, if an ordinance is designed to go after a religion.
But you claim in this case it's designed there's evidence in this case that this ordinance was designed to do something about these homes.
It is a part of the record of this case, and it's undisputed. It's also unnecessary to winning this case. All we have to show is that there was, in fact, a substantial burden, and the government failed to present its burden of proof.
Can you walk me through what that burden of proof would look like? Assume you clear the substantial burden hurdle, and assume with me that the state does not meet its burden on the remaining elements. Does that create a special class for religious institutions?
I see my time has expired. May I answer the
would
question?
Would you please?
If I understand Your Honor's question, substantial burden is met. Government fails to present its burden. That is a unique case, and that happens to be this case. Typically, the government would at least attempt to satisfy its burden. In this case, it has not done so, presented no evidence, and under the Gonzalez versus UDV U.S. Supreme Court decision recently, the facility, the religious activity, would win.
That's what I'm saying. Does that then not elevate a religious institution as a special class that's immune from a general safety regulation?
Not immune in all cases, immune only when there's no burden. But yes, Your Honor, I think that's exactly what Texas RFRA was designed to do. That's the policy judgment that the legislature unanimously adopted.
To exempt religious institutions from safety regulations.
Not to exempt, but to provide a process where the government would have to present its evidence. Normally, the government just sort of sits back, sees an ordinance, decides it wants to enforce the law, and it doesn't have to explain, you know, why me, just says the law is what the law is. Under Texas RFRA, government has to do more than that. Government has to explain, well, this is why we want to apply the statute to this particular activity. I take it that is expressly what is provided in the Texas RFRA statute.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Ho. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Villarreal will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, Carlos Villarreal here for the city of Sitton. The small city of Sitton. We have about 6,000 residents in Sitton, take about 2 square miles in area, and consistent with what I think most small towns try to do, tries to protect its citizens within the bounds of the law. In this regard, what happened here is all of a sudden, neighbors in a residential neighborhood found themselves with convicts showing up in a house that was unsupervised. Mr. Barr didn't live there. A situation that had no safety measures whatsoever with regard to the ingress and the egress of these prisoners. And they contacted, obviously, the authorities.
Now, these are prisoners under the supervision of the Texas Department of Corrections?
Yes, Your Honor. They're still in the legal custody of the Texas Department of Corrections. And they have been paroled to his facility, which the evidence in the record is clear, does not meet state statutes or state guidelines with regard to correctional rehabilitation facilities. And
but the state released them to the custody of this halfway house?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
But the state did release them to the custody of this,
yes, that's
essentially
correct.
A halfway
that's
house.
Correct. I think the record shows that a total of 15 parolees, or maybe 14 parolees and one probationer, were actually in this facility over the course of its operation.
So why didn't the citizens contact the state and say you need to?
That's exactly what happened, Your Honor. The testimony, and I regret that it's not in any of the statement of facts, but the testimony of Joe Schumann, who's the police chief, was this was going on. It came to his attention, and he called up because he thought it was a violation of state law, but he didn't want to go out there and start shutting people down. So he called the parole people and asked them what's going on. And this was actually before the ordinance was passed. I believe this is in violation of state law. They confirmed that, in fact, it was operating in violation of state law. And so at that point, they approach Mr. Barr and say, what are you doing? You shouldn't be doing this. This is in violation of state law. And the response is, well, I don't have a contract with the state, so those don't apply to me. 509 of the government code and 244 of the local government code that provide set-offs, that provide a requirement for adequate security measures for the population served, I don't have to adhere to them, was
so
Mr. Barr's response.
You acknowledge that the ordinance was directed at this home in particular, these homes in particular?
Yeah, I think the testimony was that the ordinance came after this inquiry was made, and Mr. Barr says, it doesn't apply to me. Then the ordinance came in, and what the city was trying to do was to make the same requirements that are applicable in state law applicable to the city of Sitton. And what there's a sidelight, and it's a minor point, but I do urge it as an issue in this point, that the trial court found that, in fact, these places violated 244 of the local government code and 509 of the government code, and therefore any relief with regard to the ordinance being declared unconstitutional doesn't give them the relief they request.
But I don't understand that, because the ordinance would keep them from being located where they are, whether they complied with state law or not, wouldn't it?
Well, the state law would prevent them from operating the way they want to operate, Your Honor. Is that's the finding of the trial court, that these facilities were in violation of state law.
But if they could operate within the bounds of state law, the ordinance would still prohibit them from being located where they are, within 1,000 feet of a residence, church.
If they complied with state law, then they'd be complying with the ordinance.
No, because
the ordinance and the state law are coterminous in terms of distances from residential neighborhoods, parks, and churches, etc.
Well, I guess I'm confused.
The 244 of the local government code says, and it's kind of convoluted in its explanation, but basically you've got a 1,000-foot buffer zone between a correctional rehabilitation facility and a residential neighborhood, a church, a school, etc., parks.
Have a grandfather provision?
I'm sorry?
When it was passed, did it have a grandfather provision?
The 244 of the local government code? I have not seen any, Your Honor.
I mean, it's a little different if you have a code in place and then church wants to come in and build there, or if you have a church that's there and then you pass the code.
I understand, Your Honor.
One's an unconstitutional taking, or at least arguably.
Well, there was no unconstitutional taking claim urged, and there were a lot of constitutional claims made. But there's no question that these residences still have value, so I don't think you'd have a takings claim. But with regard to the ordinance coming after these homes started to operate, first of all, they're in violation of state law anyway. But secondly,
so I'm confused then. You think it's in violation of state law? The police chief, who went out?
The police chief, Joe Schumann.
Goes out, the resident says, no, I'm not, and then the police chief stops. Is that what the police chief normally does when people are violating state law in Sinton and they say, no, I'm not, and he just throws up his hands and gives up?
Well, I think he's trying to tactfully deal with the situation, Judge.
By going to the city and saying,
this is his explanation, and at that point, the ordinance was passed. So, I mean, in terms of which came first, the state statute came first.
You're saying we're not doing anything other than what the state says, but then at the same time you're saying the state's not doing anything.
The state is doing something. The state. I mean, there's no question 244 is on the books.
Why do you need the ordinance that apparently targets this facility so that the sheriff or whoever the law enforcement is there and now has the authority of the city to act when, according to your argument, he had the authority of the state law of Texas to act?
Absolutely. The trial court so found. The trial court found them in violation.
Well, then what's
and that's why I've argued that this is moot, because they didn't challenge the state law. They're just challenging the ordinance.
Well, what's the answer to the question, though? Why do you need the ordinance if you got a state law? What's the answer to that?
The answer to that question is you don't need the ordinance.
Well, then why'd you pass it?
Well, it was passed to make sure that even if this facility wasn't contracting with the state, which was his contention, that it would still be subject to the same requirements of state law. Now, the fact of the matter is that the trial court found that he had a contract with state law with state authorities, and therefore the state law does apply. But if he didn't have a contract with the state, then the ordinance would apply.
Let me ask you this. Is there any other facility, we asked the petitioner, is there any other facility in the city of Sinton to which this would apply?
No, sir.
Now, let me make sure I understand. If these homes came into compliance, they would still be in violation of the ordinance.
If they came into compliance, I'm not sure what you mean. If they came into compliance, they'd have to be 1,000 feet away from a residential neighborhood.
If they came into compliance with state law governing halfway houses.
That's what state law provides.
They would still
under
be in violation of the ordinance.
Yes.
So well, the ordinance is not the least restrictive measure available to rectify the safety concerns.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I've made myself clear. 244 of the local government code provides for a 1,000-foot set-off. The ordinance provides for a 1,000-foot set-off. And therefore, if you're in compliance with state law, then you're in compliance with the ordinance.
And that's for facilities run by the state?
That's for facilities in which a private contractor has a contract with the state.
But your ordinance applies to a residential facility that is not operated by the state.
Right. The ordinance applies to people who have not contracted with the state. That's correct.
And the statute wouldn't apply to that?
The statute would not apply to them on its terms. That's correct.
So the reason that you couldn't do anything under the statute is because it didn't apply?
No. That's not what the trial court found. The trial court found that it does apply because there is a contract with the state, because Mr. Barr does have an agreement with the parole people. They're signing off on agreements with regard to who's being released to his premises, et cetera. So
this ordinance doesn't even apply then?
The ordinance is as applicable as state law.
Well, the ordinance applies if it's not operated by the state. The state law applies if it is operated by the state.
That's right. And the trial court found...
Those two are different.
That's right.
One's over here, one's over here.
I understand that you're trying to make them mutually exclusive, Judge.
I'm just trying to understand.
And all I'm saying is that in this case, his contention was he was not operating under state law because he didn't have a contract with the state, but the trial court found otherwise.
So the ordinance doesn't even apply, in your view?
In my estimation, the ordinance wouldn't need to apply because state law applies.
Well, but state law has to apply with RFRA. And RFRA applies to state law as well, doesn't it? Not just to city ordinances, but state statutes too.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. But RFRA has not, I mean, they have not utilized RFRA to challenge the state law that is applicable. There's absolutely no challenge to 244 or 509 in any of the plaintiff's pleadings. Judges, what amazes me is that we've been here now, I guess they argued for 15 minutes, I've argued for 10 now, 25 minutes, and nobody's mentioned 110.10 of the Civil Practice Remedies
Code. Well, he did talk a little bit about pre-1990 law and Judge Posner's decision in the Seventh Circuit.
Judge Posner's decision was not pre-1990. Judge Posner's decision that he's talking about is under RLUIPA, which was passed in the year 2000, Your Honor.
Then why was he talking about pre-1990 federal court interpretation?
Well, I didn't catch that. What I understand is he's quoting from Posner's opinion that came, I believe it was a 96 case or whatever, or maybe after that, but it was after that because it was under RLUIPA. At least what they've cited in their briefing is the religious land and religious land use and Incarcerated Persons Act, and that was passed in 2000 by the federal government. And it's very important that the court appreciate that's a distinct act with distinct definitions and standards for what you're applying. If you look at the way courts have interpreted and the way substantial burden is defined under RLUIPA, it's a much easier standard to meet. If you look at the way, as Justice Johnson was mentioning earlier, that courts have defined substantial burden under RFRA pre-1990, it's a much more difficult standard to meet. And simply moving your church, indeed, there are only six federal cases that have ever addressed this issue of zoning and a free exercise challenge to a zoning provision. And in those six cases, five of them held the ordinance was constitutional, and they involved location of churches. The sixth case they cite is the Islamic Center versus Starkville case. And it's very important because I don't have a chance to respond to their reply brief. Their reply brief misstated that the Fifth Circuit in that case applied a compelling interest standard. If you look at it, they did not apply a compelling interest standard. Indeed, they distinguished the compelling interest standard that was talked about in the Lakewood case.
You concede that the city ordinance could not be applied to churches. You couldn't pass the same city ordinance and make it churches can't be located within 1,000 feet.
Your Honor, actually, there are so many, as I say, the precedents pre-1990.
That's a yes or no. It's hypothetical, I understand. Could you pass a city ordinance? Could the city say in Sinton, no churches within 1,000 feet of a residential area, park, et cetera?
Under the pre-1990 case law, I think that they can, consistent with that case law, because that case law repeatedly held that the zoning provisions where they restricted the location of these chapels were indeed constitutional. And Those cases also recognize not only they didn't even get to the compelling interest standard. What we know from the Texas legislative history
I just want to be clear. Yes. You think, I mean, we're talking about the Texas RFRA now, and you think, consistent with that law, Sinton could pass an ordinance saying no churches within 1,000 feet of all these residential, et cetera?
Your Honor, as I said, I think that's what the case law.
I'm just asking.
Pre-1990. Yes.
You keep changing my question. My question is just whether the RFRA does not. I mean, my impression is, I didn't follow this that closely, my impression is the legislators over there would be shocked that they passed this ordinance and you say would have been perfectly fine with them to move churches away from everything inhabitable. Is that really what they intended when they passed the RFRA?
Their explicit language, which is what I have to gauge their intent by, is that notwithstanding any other provision of the Texas RFRA, the federal case law pre-1990, the authority to zone is governed by that case law pre-1990 federal cases, and those cases did indeed repeatedly allow for zoning authorities to zone out, indeed, in those cases, churches.
The sponsors of the legislation, the House and Senate sponsors, have joined an amicus brief citing Professor Laycock's testimony at some of the hearings that Section 10 really does nothing but restate the act as it applies to zoning ordinances. What's your response to that?
I think that's clearly wrong, Your Honor. If we look at the
kind of hard if the sponsors take that position, isn't it?
Well, no, I don't think it is, because what we ought to look at is what those sponsors said during the legislative process. And I quoted to you a colloquy between Representative Danberg and Representative Hochberg, in which Representative Danberg says, you know, because they introduced a purpose provision, and Justice Willett knows all about this, but they introduced a purpose provision that asked them to limit the compelling interest standard that they're utilizing to the interpretation given in Sherbert versus Verner and Wisconsin versus Yoder. And it did not pass. And it did not pass after substantial testimony that there was 100 years of jurisprudence applying many different tests aside from the compelling interest standard. And so, and Representative Hochberg was asked by Representative Danberg, what about these other cases? What about this other jurisprudence? Shouldn't we open it up to consideration all of this? And Representative Hochberg accepted that. And indeed, we know that the purpose provision didn't make it to the legislation, didn't make it to statute. So I think you can interpret that as the legislature recognizing that, in fact, the case law from all those cases prior to 1990, I can cite at least 9 of them that did not use a compelling interest standard. There are many cases, and they're all cited in the Smith case. They're cited in my brief. They're quoted in the Smith case extensively, showing you that, in fact, the compelling interest standard was not the standard that was controlling. And indeed, we can discern that from the 6 zoning cases that I've just talked about. The substantial burden standard was applied differently. They required that the ordinance or statute coerce you to violate your religion or deprive you of a benefit or privilege because of your religion. And here, none of that is taking place. So you don't meet the substantial burden standard under the case law pre-1990.
Why do you think the legislature, from your looking at the history of it, why do you think the legislature would single out in Section 10 just one kind of case?
Let me just add one more thing to what your prior question. I mentioned Representative Hochberg. I forgot that Representative Sibley also Senator Sibley rather, is on the record as stating to Ms. Aronson, you know, you'll have whatever authority you had pre-1990, you're going to have it. You lose no authority by consequence of this bill. So whatever authority there was to zone pre-1990 is what we're talking about here. That's what Representative Sibley on the record said this legislation is about.
But Professor Laycock said there was no difference, and you disagree with that.
Professor Laycock said there was no difference. Professor Davis said there was from Baylor. Professor Hamilton said there was too. The assistant city attorney, I think his name was Enkel from San Antonio, said the compelling interest standard had never been applied to zoning cases. So the legislators got an earful as to there being a number of different standards that were applied pre-1990, not just the compelling interest standard.
How do you deal with the city of Lukumi case, city out of Florida, where the U.S. Supreme Court said an ordinance that is directed at religious practice?
Yes, Your Honor.
I
think it's clearly distinguishable. If we look at what went on at those city council meetings...
Well, obviously it doesn't involve interpretation of the statute, but if we're talking about the standard, I want to incorporate that reasoning from that case into your argument.
Well, the Lukumi case, of course, Santeria religion, they want to ban animal sacrifices, but what the legislative history there showed was that they wanted to shut down that church. The mayor of the city, or the president of the city council, stated on the record, what can we do to keep this church from opening? Another councilman said, hey...
But how is that distinguishable? Looks like I thought your intent here was to shut these down, at least inside the city.
No, Your Honor. Number one, it was not our intent to shut it down in the city. We had a 1,000-foot set off, and there's testimony in the record, and they completely... I guess you hear it enough from amicuses and from these other people, and they keep misrepresenting the fact. The testimony is there were minimal locations in Sinton where these could be located.
That's
the testimony, and we've got to interpret that using a deferential standard to the trial court's fact-finding.
And you acknowledge that the only facility that came within the purview of the ordinance is the facility at issue in this case, though.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's
no question this facility raised the issue.
The city undertook an investigation. There's only one facility that would come within the purview of the ordinance, correct?
Your Honor, yes. I think the evidence before the court is clear. This
facility
brought it up.
And that investigation occurred before the ordinance was passed. That review or analysis.
Well, the citizens came to the city complaining about what was going on in their neighborhood. I think if you look at the city council minutes, you'll see several citizens very concerned with this going on. They were concerned about the security in their neighborhoods. They were concerned about the location of these premises. They were concerned about some intimidation that they perceived was going on from this facility. So that's how it came up.
Dispute that Pastor Barr's ministry is in fact a ministry?
I don't know what you mean by that, Your Honor.
It is religious expression. It is them kind of living out their religious convictions.
I think he was pursuing his religion.
Okay. What is your definition? What definition would you use as to substantial burden? And did this substantially burden his ministry?
Your Honor, what I go back to is, again, 110.10 of the Texas RFRA refers us to the pre-1990 case law. And if we look at that case law, if you look at the Brownfield opinion, I think it's Brownfield versus Brown, and if you look at the Ling versus National Forest people, those cases speak in terms of a substantial burden requiring a showing that the ordinance coerced you to violate your religion or alternatively deprived you of some privilege or benefit as a consequence of your religion. And that simply isn't here. The standard for substantial burden has changed. They cite you a lot of RLIPA cases, and they cite you a lot of more recent authorities where the definition of that standard has changed. And the court needs to be very careful to look at the pre-1990 cases, because I think the standard there clearly warrants finding that this that they have
they
not
to
proven
move out of the city,
burden.
Assuming they had to move out of the city to do this, your opinion is, and your position is, it would not substantially burden under the appropriate standards.
Your Honor, that's true, but I want to make it clear. The testimony before this court was that there were minimal locations within Sinton where this
could be
located.
We'll look at the record.
And if you look at, and I've provided you with the census maps of what Sinton is, and what amazes me is you'll find that there are these areas that are covered on all three sides by the city of Sinton. There are huge fields out there. And you got to keep in mind that the trial court judge knows Sinton. Even the appellate court judges know Sinton. If you know this community, you don't drive through it for miles being in city limits while there are fields and fields. But there are plenty of fields outside the city limits.
Other questions?
Just one other question, Chief. Just in a sentence or two, precisely how do you believe the standard, the definition of substantial burden, has changed pre-1990 versus post?
Yes, Your Honor. Pre-1990, I think I just articulated it. I won't bore the court by repeating that. Post-1990, as I see the opinions, is basically if you're inhibited in a material way from practicing your religion, then that's a substantial burden. And I think that's a change that RLUIPA brought.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. The city is here today demanding a carve-out of zoning from RFRA, from 010. The legislature's text is clear, it does not provide a carve-out, and if you want to look for a carve-out, look no further than the very next provision, 011. That is a carve-out for human rights. That is not the language provided in 010 for zoning.
Mr. Ho, I'm familiar with the city of Sinton. I've driven through it. It seems to be an open area. Is there any situation where this ordinance would be valid? Say if this home existed in a very nice neighborhood in Houston, like River Oaks, and the city of Houston decided to pass this type of ordinance. Does it matter where it's located? It seems to me that I just want to make sure the standards are applied, whether this type of situation existed in a barrio or existed in River Oaks. I mean, it seems to me we wouldn't hear the same uproar.
Let me try to ease Your Honor's concerns. All we're talking about at the first stage is substantial burden. If there is a compelling interest, the government can step in and explain its interest. In this case, there was no evidence whatsoever because the city didn't acknowledge that Texas RFRA provides any protection whatsoever. If a city has a reason, if it doesn't like sex offenders, drug offenders, any number of categories, it can walk in and it can win that case. I want to talk about the pre-1990 case law very quickly.
Could you expand on that? How could they do that? By raising what, the compelling interest is to protect our children from sex offenders?
You could have a city mayor or a city official come into court and testify that this is the reason we passed this ordinance. This is why it has to be applied specifically to the religion. In this case, there was no such testimony. They simply folded their arms and said it's the law and that's all that matters. The pre-1990 case law is unequivocal. Every single case to have addressed this issue before 1990 applied the compelling interest test to zoning. The Fifth Circuit did that in Islamic Center. There are Sixth Circuit, Ninth Circuit, and even Eleventh Circuit cases. With respect to substantial burden, they cite not a single case relevant to relevant to our fact pattern, where we have an expulsion of a pre-existing facility from city limits. And the Fifth Circuit in Islamic Center found a substantial burden from even less facts, where there was a new facility and where there were locations within the city.
Do you agree that the state law provides the same setback as the city ordinance?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if the facility is in violation of the state law, why would it be allowed to exist under those conditions?
This facility does not violate state law. The Court of Appeal has never found such. The state law simply does not apply in this case.
Well, there's a trial court finding on that issue, correct?
There is a trial court finding, but it's plainly rejected by the law, by the express provisions of the state statute, and that's why the Court of Appeals didn't agree.
Have you challenged that here?
We've not challenged that here because it does not apply here. The state law applies to state-owned or state-contracted facilities.
Trial court found that you were in violation of the state law and it's not been challenged on appeal, what does that... First of all, let me make sure. Have you challenged the trial court finding that you're in violation of state law on appeal? Have you challenged that?
The
court appeals are here.
What we've challenged is exactly what happened here. The city said that the ordinance needs to be enforced. That's the reason why the state officials decided to expel the city, decided to go along with what the city was asking.
But if the trial court found you were in violation of the state law, has that finding been challenged on appeal?
I'm sorry?
The trial court found you were in violation of state law, as I understand. Is that you agree with that?
I believe that is one of the factual findings.
Has that finding been challenged on appeal?
What we're challenging is exactly what the Court of Appeals addressed. The Court of Appeals, it was challenged. Let me say that.
It was challenged in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals did not reach it.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
Apologize for the confusion. The decisions below and the city's position here present essentially a roadmap for local governments to resist the policy judgments of the legislature in the area of zoning. deny that zoning laws ever impose a substantial burden, deny that zoning laws are ever subject to compelling interest and least restrictive means requirements, and deny that the city has any burden whatsoever to present any evidence. This court should do at least two things. One, reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals below and make clear that Texas RFRA does in fact provide protection to churches and to ministries against zoning laws when the zoning laws are unjustified. The second thing this court should do, I see that my time is up.
Complete your sentence.
Thank you, Your Honor. The second thing this court should do is to instruct the trial court that an injunction is appropriate in this context. And the only question is, what kind of injunction? How broad? How narrow? Which individuals may be allowed to live? And what measures? Outright prohibition versus security or supervision? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ho. The cause is submitted. That completes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oye, 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 the Honorable Supreme Court.